Welcome everyone to the pilot episode of Under the Crawl Space. This is a true crime comedy podcast where I'll cover everything from the Manson family to the BTK killer, Dennis Rader. So I hope you enjoy. This is a disclaimer. There will be mentionings of murder, rape, sexual assault, mutilation, all that comes with serial killers and stuff like that. So if you're not privy to that, and if you're eating, I recommend not listening because it can get pretty graphic. but yeah, hope you enjoy. Today we're talking about Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer. Edmund Emil Kemper III, or Ed, one of the most notorious serial killers, also known as the co-ed killer or the co-ed butcher, terrorized Santa Cruz, California from 1972 to 1973, killing a total of 10 people, 6 young college co-eds, his grandparents being the first, and his mother and her best friend being the last. Kemper was born in California December 18, 1948. After a divorce between his parents, he moved with his verbally abusive mother to Helena, Montana, with his two sisters as well. As a child, Kemper's mother, Clarnell Stage, kept him in a dark basement room with a light and a bed, while his sisters were able to sleep upstairs. Kemper felt this was unfair, saying in a prison interview that he felt as though he was being cast into hell with all the things that he was afraid of, and his sisters got to go to heaven and be angels. And his mother kept him down there because she was afraid that he would rape both of his sisters. At the age of 15, on August 27th, 1964, Kemper got into an argument with his grandmother, Maud Matilda Huey. Kemper stormed off and grabbed a rifle his grandfather had given him for hunting. Re-entering the kitchen, Kemper shot his grandmother in the head before finishing her off with 2 shots to the back of the head. When the OG, the original Kemper, Edmund Emil Kemper, Kemper's grandfather, returned from the grocery store, Kemper met him in the driveway and fatally shot him with said rifle, saying, quote, "I did not want him to see his dead wife," unquote. This would be Kemper's first and second murders, and these crimes landed him in Atascadero, California, youth psychiatry, where social workers deemed him fit. Believe it or not, I don't know how that happened. He was later diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, which sounds a bit, more correct. Before being released, doctors told authorities that Kemper should not be sent to live with his mother because of the abuse she put him through during early childhood. With this advice in mind, Kemper still joined his mother in Santa Cruz, where his crimes would take place. So at the age of 21, he's released from Atascadero. He moves to Santa Cruz to be with his mother, against the advice of doctors, because he had that early childhood abuse from her. Now, Kemper's mother, Clarnell Stage, worked at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she was a building administrator. She was very good at her job and was held in high regard. But when it came to Kemper, she was still as cold as can be, telling him things along the lines of, "Those girls are too good for you, and you don't actually believe they want to be with you, do you?" Also, I have not mentioned, but Edmund Kemper was 6'9", 300 pounds, and had an IQ of 145. So he was extremely smart and fucking huge. Kemper would pick up college co-eds from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and bring them home without doing anything, just literally like be an Uber, basically. And because people used to hitchhike all the fucking time back in the 70s, which is why so many serial killers were able to kill mass amounts of people, such as Ted Bundy, who basically did the same thing. So he would pick them up and just bring them wherever they wanted to go. And so he could contain himself, but on May 7th, 1972, Kemper picked up 2 18-year-old college students, Marianne Pessy and Anita Lucchesa, with the intention of bringing both women to Stanford University. After driving for an hour, he managed to reach a secluded wooded area near Alameda, which he was familiar with from his work at the highway department. Without alerting his passengers that he had changed directions from where they wanted to go, here he intended to, and I'm just going to say this now, it's going to get very graphic, so there's the disclaimer. He intended to rape them, but having learned from serial rapists in Atascadero to not leave witnesses, he instead handcuffed Pessy and locked Luchessa in the trunk. Now, when he initially went to stab Pessy, he was shocked because, you know, he thought it was just gonna, it was going to be like a butter knife going through butter, like a hot butter knife going through butter. But it bounced off of her. It bounced off of her chest plate. So like the thing that covers your heart and is connected to your ribs and stuff like that, it bounced off. And he thought it was just going to go through. So he stabbed and strangled Pessy to death before killing Luchessa in a similar manner. Now, Kemper later confessed in a prison interview that while handcuffing Pessy, he brushed the back of his hand up against one of her breasts, and it embarrassed him. Before adding that, he even said, whoops, I'm sorry, or something like that, after grazing her breast, despite murdering her literally minutes later. Kemper put both of the women's bodies in the trunk of his Ford Galaxy and returned to his apartment. He was stopped on the way by a police officer for having a broken taillight. This is similar to another notorious serial killer, Ted Bundy, who was also pulled over by a police officer August 16th of 1972. And the police officer found a crowbar, a ski mask, and a bunch of other things in his car, and he was arrested. And, you know, that's basically where his killing story ends. But we're talking about Kemper. So the officer didn't detect the corpses in the car, even though most likely there was blood all over the back seats or the front seats or whatever. He didn't just couldn't see it. Like, he's just like blind. But Kemper's roommate was not home, so he took the bodies to his apartment, where he took photographs of and had sexual intercourse with the naked corpses before dismembering them. He then put the body parts into a plastic bag, which he later abandoned near Loma Prieta Mountain, before disposing of Pessy's and Luchessa's severed heads in a ravine. Kemper engaged in necrophilia, which is the act of having sex with a corpse. Not good. Not cool. Very not cash money. In August, Pessy's skull was found on Loma Prieta Mountain. An extensive search failed to turn up the rest of Pessy's remains or a trace of Luchessa. So Luchessa has never, her remains have never been found. On the evening of September 14th, 1972, this was 5 months after the murders of Marianne Pessy and Anita Luchessa, Kemper picked up a 15-year-old dance student who was hitchhiking instead of grabbing a bus to go to her dance class. This was Aiko Ku. He again drove to a remote area with her and pulled a gun on Ku before accidentally locking himself out of the car. And this is what just baffles me, is like, he locked himself out of the car with the gun in the car with Aiko Ku, right? She let him back inside. She let him back inside the car. He proceeded to choke her unconscious, rape her, and kill her. He subsequently packed her body into the trunk of his car, had a few drinks at a nearby bar, then exited the bar and opened his trunk, admiring his catch like a fisherman, and returned to his apartment. Back at his apartment, he had sexual intercourse with the corpse, necrophilia, dismembering and disposing of the remains in a similar manner as his previous two victims. Ku's mother called the police to report the disappearance of her daughter and put up hundreds of flyers asking for information, but did not receive any responses regarding her daughter's location or status. And that's the last we hear about Aiko Ku. I don't believe she was ever found, any of her remains. But yeah. So a few months later, this is in the new year, this is 1973, January 7th, Kemper, who had moved back in with his mother, was driving around the Cabrillo College campus when he picked up 18-year-old student Cynthia Ann Cindy Shaw. He drove to a sequestered wooded area and fatally shot her with a .22 caliber pistol. He then placed her body in the trunk of his car like all his other victims. And again, just like all his other victims, drove to his mother's house where he kept her body hidden in a closet in his room overnight. When his mother left for work the next morning, he took part in necrophilia with the corpse. He removed the bullet from Shaw's corpse to get rid of any trace or any evidence that could be linked back to him, which we're going to talk about this because the ending of this whole thing is kind of weird. He had sexual intercourse with before dismembering and decapitating her in his mother's bathtub. Kemper kept Shaw's severed head for several days, regularly engaging in necrophilia with it, for burying it in his mother's garden, facing upward toward her bedroom, later remarking that his mother, quote, always wanted people to look up to her, end quote. He discarded the rest of her remains by throwing them off a cliff. Over the course of the following few weeks, all but Shaw's head and right hand were discovered and pieced together like a macabre jigsaw puzzle. Police and a pathologist determined that she had been hacked to death, then cut to pieces with a power saw. So they found everything but her head and her right hand, and that's the last that we hear of Cindy Shaw. Now, a month after Cindy Shaw's murder, February 5th, 1973, after a heated argument with his mother, and it all comes back to, it's usually after an argument with his mother that drives him over the edge, that basically makes him, not makes him, but compels him to go out and kill, because he just gets so enraged and has to take it out on somebody, but doesn't want to take it out on his mother yet, so he kills co-eds. He picks up hitchhikers. Kemper left his house in search of possible victims with heightened suspicion of a serial killer preying on hitchhikers in the Santa Cruz area. Students were advised to only get into cars with university stickers on them, which Kemper had, because his mother worked at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He encountered 23-year-old Rosalind Heather Thorpe and 20-year-old Alice Helen Allison Lou, that's a bunch of names, on the UCSC campus. That's the University of California's Santa Cruz. According to Kemper, Thorpe entered his car first, which reassured Lou to also enter. He then fatally shot Thorpe and Lou with his .22 caliber pistol and wrapped their bodies in blankets. Just like all his other victims, Kemper brought his victims back to his mother's house, this time beheaded them in his car and carried the headless corpses to his mother's house to have sexual intercourse with them. This is his MO. He does this every single time. So you probably know what he does. He dismembers them, remove bullets to prevent identification. The next morning, he goes and dumps the bodies. Some of the remains were found at Eden Canyon a week later, and more were found near Highway 1 in March. When questioned in an interview as to why he removed the victim's heads, before performing sexual acts on the body, he explained, the head trip fantasies were like a bit of a, like a trophy. You know, the head is where everything is at, the brain, the eyes, the mouth, that's the person. I remember being told as a kid, you cut off the head and the body dies. The body is nothing after the head is cut off. Well, that's not quite true. There's a lot left to a girl's body without the head, unquote. On April 20th, 1973, after coming home from a party, 52-year-old Clarnell Elizabeth Strandberg, or Clarnell Stage, who was Kemper's mother, while sitting in her bed reading a book, she noticed Kemper enter her room and said to him, I suppose you're going to want to sit up and talk all night. Which Kemper replied, no, good night. He then waited for her to fall asleep before returning to bludgeon her with a claw hammer and slit her throat with a knife. He subsequently decapitated her and engaged in necrophilic acts with her severed head before using it as a dartboard. Kemper stated that he put her head on a shelf and screamed at it for an hour, threw darts at it, and ultimately smashed her face in. And this is his mother, so he's gotten to his mother now. He also cut out her tongue and her vocal cords and put them in the garbage disposal. However, the muscles, which are the vocal cords and the tongue, were too thick for the blades of the garbage disposal, so it spit it back up into the sink. And Kemper said in an interview, quote, that seemed appropriate, unquote, and also said, quote, as much as she'd bitched it and screamed and yelled at me over so many years, I finally shut her up, unquote. Kemper then hid his mother's corpse in a closet and went out to drink. Now, here's the thing. Edmund Kemper was buddy-buddy with all the cops in town. All of them. He drank at a bar called the Jury Room, which all of the detectives, all of the patrol officers, all of the California Highway Patrol officers, they all drank there. And they would talk about the cases, and he would ask them about them. And they never had any suspicions about him at all. They just thought he was a cool guy. He was very intelligent, like I said earlier, 145 IQ. So he knows how to talk his way around people. So after hiding his mother's body in a closet, he went out to drink. Upon his return, he invited his mother's best friend, 59-year-old Sarah Taylor Sally Hallett. So Sarah Taylor, or her nickname, Sally Hallett, over to the house for dinner and a movie. And at this point, I don't know how his mother's house is not smelling like absolute garbage. It just beats me. I just don't get it. When Hallett arrived, Kemper strangled her to death, decapitated her, and spent the night with her dead body. He subsequently put her corpse in a closet, obscured any outward signs of disturbance, and left a note to the police, and it reads as follows. Approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday. No need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents. Just a lack of time. I got things to do. Unquote. Kemper then fled the scene, driving to Pueblo, Colorado. And this is where, when I said earlier, when I said when he was taking bullets out to hide evidence, the cops were not even looking at him for this crime. They had gone to his house a few months earlier, like half a year earlier, because even though his juvenile records were expunged, on the file, they could see at the gun shop where he'd bought his gun, they could see through the marker, and it said that he had killed his parents. Like, they could see that it said that. So a detective went over there and basically was like, hey, Ed, I need to see the gun. And he gives him the gun, and it, you know, surprisingly, they were not there for the gun that he used in all these crimes. They were there for his .45, not his .22. But he drives to Pueblo, Colorado after killing his mother and her best friend. After not hearing any news on the radio about the murders of his mother and Hallett when he arrived in Pueblo, he found a phone booth and called the police and confessed to the murders of his mother and Hallett. But the police did not take his call seriously. Again, going back to, he was good friends with all the detectives, all the police officers, because he drank at the Jury Room. And so several hours later, Kemper calls again, asking to speak to an officer he knew personally, which is the one that went to go and get the gun from him. Kemper confessed to that officer of killing his mother and Hallett and waited for the police to arrive and take him into custody, where he also confessed to the murders of the six students. When asked why he turned himself in, Kemper said the original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real or emotional purpose. It was just pure waste of time. Emotionally, I couldn't handle it much longer. Toward the end there, I started to feel the folly of the whole damn thing. And at that point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said to hell with it and called it off. Kemper was indicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder on May 7th, 1973, 1 year to the day. He killed Marianne Pesce and Anita Lucchesa. He killed them May 7th, 1972. He was assigned the Chief Public Defender of Santa Cruz, Attorney Jim Jackson. Due to Kemper's explicit and detailed confession, his counsel's only option was to plead no guilty by reason of insanity to the charges. Kemper twice tried to commit suicide in custody. His trial went ahead on October 23rd, 1973. Three court-appointed psychiatrists found Kemper to be legally sane, which still, like, just fucking baffles me, because he's obviously not. Like, he's obviously a very sick fucking dude. If he's doing all this shit, like, literally putting fucking vocal cords into a garbage disposal and just if you are fucking decapitating people, you're not sane. That's not a thing a sane person does. One of the psychiatrists, Dr. Joel Fort, investigated his juvenile records and the diagnosis that he was once psychotic. Fort also interviewed Kemper, including under truth serum, which I cannot remember if it's sodium nitrate, I think. That is truth serum. I can't remember, though. And relayed to the court that Kemper had engaged in cannibalism, alleging that he had sliced flesh from the legs of the victims, then cooked and consumed these strips of flesh in a casserole. Nevertheless, Fort determined that Kemper was fully cognizant, I can't say that fucking word, sorry, in each case, and stated that Kemper enjoyed the prospect of the infamy associated with being labeled a murderer. Kemper later recanted the confession of cannibalism. So California used the McNaughton standard, which held that for a defendant to establish a defense on the ground of insanity, it must be clearly proved that at the time of committing the act, the party accused was laboring under such a defective reason from disease of mind, and not to know the nature and quality of the act that he was doing. So basically, to be declared insane, you have to not have, you know, you basically cannot know what you're doing. Like, whatever you're doing, you cannot, like, you just don't know the vast impact of what you are doing. Is the really the only way in California that you can be declared insane, which he didn't know what he was doing. So, I mean, Kemper appeared to have known that the nature of his acts was wrong and had showed signs of malice aforethought. On November 1st, Kemper took the stand and he testified that he killed the victims because he wanted them for myself, quote, for myself like possessions, unquote, and attempted to convince the jury that he was insane based on reasoning that his actions could only have been committed by someone with an apparent mind. He said two things inhabited his body, and that when the killer personality took over, it was kind of like blacking out. So that's kind of like a DID thing, like formerly known as multiple personality disorder, now known as, I think it's dissociative identity disorder, where basically you have alters and stuff like that, to where, like I said earlier, the trigger of that, because it comes with a trigger. So like something happens and an alter that can actually handle that will take over. A different personality that can actually handle that will take over. So that's when, like when I was saying, he usually killed after getting in arguments with his mother. That would be a trigger for him to switch in an alter if he had DID, blacking out from his, you know, OG alter, which is Ed Kemper, and becoming the co-ed killer, if you catch my drift. On November 8th, which is my birthday, the six-man, 1973, the six-man, six-woman jury took 5 hours to declare Kemper sane and guilty on all counts. He asked for the death penalty, requesting death by torture. However, with a pause placed on capital punishment by the Supreme Court at the time, he received 7 years to life for each count, with these terms being served concurrently. Now, if you don't know the difference between concurrent and consecutive, concurrent means that when you're charged, you serve all the sentences at the same time. So basically, he had seven life sentences. He had, eight life sentences, and he served all those at the same time. Whereas consecutive sentences is you finish. So say he got that eight life sentences running consecutively. Then he would finish one life sentence for one of those deaths, and then the new one would start. So not serving all at the same time, you serve one, that ends, then you start the next one. So you're never getting out of fucking prison, basically. And he was sent off to the California Medical Facility, even though he was declared sane. In the California Medical Facility, Kemper was incarcerated in the same prison block as other notorious criminals, such as Herbert Mullen and Charles Manson. So Herbert Mullen, okay, so like basically everybody knows who Charles Manson is. He's fucking Charles Manson. But Herbert Mullen was a serial killer who operated at the same time from 72 to 73 in the same area, Santa Cruz, as Kemper. So they were both operated at the exact same time. He described Mullen as just a cold-blooded killer, which, like, come on, Kemper, what the fuck are you? Like, a warm-blooded killer? Like, come on. And Herbert Mullen was a paranoid schizophrenic, just the same as Kemper. I don't get how these guys, they have so much in common. Just start fucking dating, why don't they? But Herbert Mullen was a paranoid schizophrenic who believed that there was going to be an earthquake that was going to kill a bunch of people. So he killed 13 people and took their blood, and I'm doing air quotes, you can't see them, but fed it to the earth to prevent this earthquake. So that's a little bit about Herbert Mullen. But the funny shit is Kemper bullied, basically. He bullied Herbert Mullen because they were like neighbors in their cells. Like Kemper was in one cell, and then the guy directly next to him was Herbert Mullen. And Mullen was 5'7", so Kemper was like fucking more than a foot taller than this guy. And Kemper had stated that Mullen had a habit of singing and bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV. So I quote, "I threw water on him to shut him up. Then, when he was a good boy, I'd give him peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts." That was effective because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavior modification treatment. Kemper remains among the general population in prison and is considered a model prisoner. He was in charge of scheduling other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists and was accomplished craftsman of ceramic cups. What a trait, man. He was also a prolific reader of books on tape for the blind, which is true. He read more than 5,000 hours for like audiobooks for blind people. And he was retired from those positions in 2015, which is very recent because he's still alive. He hasn't died in prison. I think he's 72 now. After he experienced a stroke and was declared medically disabled, he received his first rule violation in 2016 for failing to provide a urine sample. While in prison, Kemper was has participated in a number of interviews. Like, this dude has fucking so many interviews. Like, he is just an open book when it comes to the murders that he committed. Not saying he's proud of them. Not saying he's not proud of them. He just knows what he did and is open and talking about it. Whereas Bundy, to the day he fucking was fried in the chair, he fought it. He tried to say he was innocent the entire time when there was, dental records that proved he had double bit in one of the girls' thighs in the fucking FSU house that he broke into. So Kemper, even, yeah, he pled basically pled guilty on the stand at his trial as well. So he was an open book. So FBI profiler John Douglas. Now this guy, when you think of Criminal Minds, you think of the BAU, you think of the Behavioral Analysis Unit. You probably think of Hotch and fucking Morgan and Prentice and JJ and stuff like that. But John Douglas is the guy, along with what's his name? Joe Ressler, I believe. They created the BAU. They are the two FBI profilers that created the BAU. And John Douglas is the one that coined the term serial killer. And he described Kemper as one of the brightest prison inmates he had ever interviewed and capable of rare insight for a violent criminal. Kemper is forthcoming about the nature of his crimes and has stated that he participated in the interviews to save others like himself from killing. So I wouldn't really say, I don't know if I'd say he's a psychopath. He might be sociopath or, just have him fucking just really fucked up in the head. At the end of his murder, no apparent motive interview, he said, "There's somebody out there that is watching this and hasn't done that, hasn't killed people and wants to, rages inside and struggles with that feeling, or so sure they have it under control they need to talk to somebody about it. Trust somebody enough to sit down and talk about something that isn't a crime. Thinking that way isn't a crime. Doing it isn't a crime. It's a horrible thing. It doesn't know when to quit. It can't be stopped easily once it starts." That was my best Ed Kemper impression. He also conducted an interview with French writer Stéphane Bourgeon in 1991. Now, Kemper was first eligible for parole in 79. He was denied parole that year, as well as at parole hearings in 80, 81, and 82. He subsequently waived his right to a hearing in 85, and he was denied a parole hearing in 88, because he is Ed Kemper, where he said, "Society's not ready in any shape or form for me. I can't fault them for that." He was denied parole again in 91 and 94. He then waived his right to a hearing in 97. In 02, he attended the next hearing in 2007, where he was again denied parole because, come on, like, come on. Do they, like, why do they even keep filing appeals? Like, I get that, like, you don't actually file, like, if you're up for parole, then you're up for parole. But it's like, why keep putting him up for parole if you know he's a fucking serial killer? He's going to kill again. Like, there's no doubt. I mean, maybe not him, because he killed his mother and he was basically done after that, but he definitely hurt people. We don't care how much of a model prisoner he is, and this is Prosecutor Adrian Simmons saying, we don't care how much of a model prisoner he is because of the enormity of his crimes, which is true. He decapitated and, you know, desecrated dead bodies. Just for the hell of it, basically. Kepler waived his right to a hearing again in 2012 and was denied a parole hearing in 2017, which was 4 years ago. Crazy, actually. And is next eligible in 2024. And that, my friends, concludes the first episode, the pilot episode of Under the Crawl Space. I hope you enjoyed. I hope I wasn't too much of a dunce this episode. I don't know who I want to do next podcast episode. Thinking maybe Herbert Mullin, maybe Robert Picton, the pig farm killer, or I could just do Bundy. But, anyways, that concludes this episode, and I'll see you in the next one.